We left off last week. We're just about finished with the Gemara. The only thing we have left to discuss are knives. Okay. I didn't bring any. We'll save any demonstrations or examples for when we get there. But one of the issues with knives actually comes up in the Gemara in Sachem, and we touched upon the issue. But the basic problem that we have to deal with in terms of knives is that our Gemara, as we're going to see, is going to claim that knives only require hagalas, immersion in the boiling water. They don't require libun. And yet there are other passages that suggest that a knife, the kasher knife, you actually have to put it, in the fire, or however you're going to do that. So before we get, in order to present sort of the contradiction, it was also relevant to do the Gemara in Pesachim, which is one of the, there are really two main sugyas that deal with Heksha Kalim, with Kashrim of Kalim. One is the Gemara Pesachim we're looking at, and the other is the one that we've just done in Maseches Avodah Zarah. So, as just a little bit of backdrop to this, everybody agrees that Chametz on Pesach may not be eaten. I know that's not a novel point, and that it is a Torah prohibition. There is, however, a prohibition on Chametz before Pesach and after Pesach. Before Pesach is from, at least Min HaTorah, is from noon and onward on Erev Pesach. And after Pesach applies to any chametz that was owned by a Jew during Pesach is prohibited afterwards. Now, there is, the way we paskin, the prohibition of chametz after noon, literally, on Erev Pesach is a Torah prohibition. It doesn't carry the same penalty as chametz on Pesach, meaning there's no penalty of kares, so the heavenly death penalty for eating it. There is, however, malkos. You do get lashes for it. And so that's one difference. Also, we paskin that chametz on Pesach has no bittul. No matter how much non-chametz it gets mixed into, it always makes it aser. Whereas, on Erev Pesach, after chatzos, it's batel b'shishim. That bittul still works. Okay. What about after Pesach? So after Pesach is a major debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yehuda believes that chametz she'avar alav Pesach, chametz, and it's worth clarifying, it doesn't matter whether a Jew owned it or a non-Jew owned it. Rabbi Yehuda believes that chametz that existed during Pesach is usser after Pesach min haTorah. Just like it would be usser, right before Pesach on the 6 hours, it is usser after Pesach forever. Rabbi Shimon is of the opinion that chametz she'avar alav haPesach is not a Torah prohibition. If it was owned by a non-Jew, then it is permitted for a Jew then to buy it and consume it. If it was owned by a Jew during Pesach, then there's a rabbinic prohibition of eating it, getting benefit from it, a gezeirah midrabbanan, so that people won't decide to violate the Torah prohibition of keeping their chametz over Pesach, because they'll figure I'll eat it after Pesach. Right? So that is that's the backdrop to this Gemara. That's number one. Number two, one other piece, and we've already learned this piece. The other piece that we've already seen is what is the status of bittul. What are the general rules of bittul? So some of you have heard this for the umpteenth time, which is that Rav and Shmuel say that every isser in the Torah, it doesn't matter what it is, bimino, if it falls into something of its own kind, it's aser. It's no different. We saw Yayin Esach and Tevel were mentioned in our mission explicitly in Avodah Zarah. Rav and Shmuel, and we learned that Gemara, it appears both on the previous Amud, the one I haven't given you, Msachim, and we learned it in the fifth parak of Avodah Zarah. Rav and Shmuel say, all Isurim in the Torah, if it falls into the same kind of food, it's Oser B'mashehu, there's no Bittul. If it falls into something else, then it's Ben Osein Tam, it's Batel B'shishim. If you have 60 and you can't taste it, it's fine. And Rav and Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish say no. They say all Isurim in the Torah generally, whether it falls into Mino, whether it falls into Edo Mino, doesn't make a difference. It's Batel B'shishim. 60 is enough to move Batel. The exception being Yayin Nesech and Tevel. Those were the exceptions where B'she'eno Mino falls into some other kind of food, it's Batel B'shishim. If it falls, wine that falls into wine, and Tevel, whatever kind of produce it is that falls into the same kind of produce, is B'mashah. Marshall.
If they do, how do the Rabbanu who hold that Min B'mino is always Aser square that with Acharov, where if there were five distinct pieces of meat in the Shuk, I mean, isn't that kind of a form of Min B'mino?
So the answer is no. Your question is an excellent question, but the answer is there's a difference between something that's blended and something that you might that is discrete, in the sense that I just want to think if it's a good analogy. Yeah, it's not a bad analogy, since we'll be learning brachos. I get this this question comes up often. It's the difference between the Gemara has a rule. The rule the Gemara presents in the sixth parak in brachos, it'll be a while till we get there, is that koshi yesh bo mechameshes haminim, you always make a mizonos on it. If it has one of the five species of grain, whatever they are, you make a mizonos on it. Which would mean, I assume that chulant, I assume the barley and chulant, you make a mizonos on that barley. And therefore, when you serve me chulant with barley, it doesn't matter what else is in the chulant, I am going to make a bari mine mizonos. That's my bracha, my one bracha on the chulant. The only time I won't make such a bracha is if there was, let's say, flour as a thickener as opposed to there for real flavor. Fine. Now, what happens then if you get an ice cream sandwich? Okay, you have an ice cream sandwich. So on the one hand, which is the ikar of the ice cream? What's the primary food there? I think it's the ice cream. Some people might disagree, but I see marshals, you know, they're not sure. Let's grant me my mishagas, and I say it's the ice cream. That's really what I'm after. So do we say now, no, but there's clearly a cracker there, which I'm eating with the ice cream, and therefore I should make mizonos on it. So I think the answer is no. And there's a Ritva who says this, and he doesn't talk about ice cream sandwiches, but he talks about conceptually the same things, who says that there's a difference between when something is all mixed together versus when you're eating two things together at the same time. When I'm eating two things together at the same time, I have to decide which is the ikar and which is the tafel. But once I blend it together, I have to decide what is this food in front of me. And the answer is, if I have to label the food as one thing, well, if there is some one of the five grains in there, that's a bari mizonos. That's the way it is. But once I'm eating things separately, I can decide what is ikar, what is tafel. Now, it's not perfectly analogous, but I think the same thing is true here. When I take things and I blend them together, I have one substance now, and the rule is that this is really a bittul. This is about bittul. It's not about rov. Understandably, in order to have bittul, the starting point has to be that the heter has to certainly be more physically than the iser. When I have separate discrete pieces, this is a game of probability. It's not bittul anymore. That's where rov comes in. That's really where, in fact, the Gemara, the Gemara uses the language in both cases. They'll talk about mimimino baruba is berov min haTorah, but I think that that there we use the term bittul. I think when it comes to what we call yavesh biyavesh, discrete items, you know, we each stand separate. So there, it's not so clear whether that's bittul or that's just rov and probability. It may be a machlokas harishonim, but I think that would be the difference fundamentally. Okay. So now, it comes to one of my favorite issues, which is what do you do with kelim that have chametz absorbed in them? Now, what do you do when Pesach comes? So, as we mentioned before, some people foolishly sell their kelim. Now, if they're China, it's not a problem. But if you sell your metal pots or your metal silverware because you're so stringent and pious, so you run into a little problem, which is when you buy your stuff back after Pesach, you have to do Tfilas Kelim again. So, talking about no good deed goes unpunished. Maybe it's not such a good deed. Okay, so the next step is, but let's say it's earthenware. So what, and any kli, what happens after Pesach when you cook in these kelim? And this chametz absorbed in them. Now, if you had asked me, I would have said the following. I would have said, firstly, there's no prohibition, it would appear, to keeping these kelim during Pesach. Nobody says that you can't. I'm not allowed to own Oreo cookies or Fryhofer's bread. But there's no prohibition on my owning my kelim that have perhaps absorbed inside them chametz. One would say that's not chametz shavala. Pesach, the Torah says, bal yira, bal yimotze. Now, literally, just because you put your chametz, you cover it with a cloth, doesn't mean you don't violate bal yira, bal yimotze. But something that is simply invisible by its definition, it's quite plausible that there is no bal yira, bal yimotze. And therefore, there's no gzeira on such a thing. And if you held like Rabbi Shimon, certainly, that chametz she'avarla Pesach in the first place, after Pesach, is only a rabbinic prohibition so that you don't come to violate bayira bayimotze. So then one could see that there's no problem whatsoever of using the pots after Pesach, right? Because you didn't violate bayira bayimotze, there is no rabbinic gezeira on this. As an aside, I should note, if you did bittul on chametz, and then you discover a cookie after Pesach, you're not allowed to eat it. Even though you didn't violate it by your Rabbi Imatze, there is, the Rishonim say, you're still not allowed to. But that is talking about real chametz. Nobody would say that with respect to what which is absorbed in the kelim. You didn't violate by your Rabbi Imatze, you can't violate by your Rabbi Imatze on such chametz. There's no rabbinic decree after Pesach on using these pots. But if you hold that chametz sh'avar al Pesach is a Torah prohibition, it has nothing to do with the violation of that you kept chametz on Pesach. It has nothing to do with that. You didn't do anything wrong. But it doesn't matter. If there's chametz in the pots, perhaps it's a problem after Pesach. Now, there is one perhaps mitigating circumstance, but not everybody necessarily agrees to it. Any chametz in the pots after Pesach should be, by definition, no sein tam lefgam. Any flavor that, remember, our rule is 24 hours, and that's a chumrah. Right? Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam said if you leave the pot unused overnight, the next day already the flavor that the pot will emit into the food is already pogame. It already damages the food. So if you left it for at least a week, it's certainly going to be pogame. So you have sort of a couple of things working in your favor. So nonetheless, if you learn now, look on the page, on the side with the big lamed on it, where lamed amid aleph, about 10 lines down by the two dots, the colon. Omar Rav, Kideros ba Pesach Yishaveru. If you have pots, I don't think it means you cook chametz in on Pesach. It means you have pots that you kept over Pesach. And they were earthenware pots. Rav says after Pesach, I mean at any point, you should break the pots. You can't use the pots to cook in. So the Gemara says, Vamai, Lishinu achar ha-Pesach v'li aved b'hu shelo b'mina. So the Gemara says, well, I don't understand, Rav. I have a suggestion for you. Why don't you save the chametz? Here's Rav's problem. Rav's problem would be that if I take this pot that is absorbed chametz and I use it after Pesach, even though it's after Pesach, and even though the chametz is pogame, so Rav, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah had a question about this. This Gemara seems to be assuming that Rav believes that no sein tam lefgam is aser. Right? This was a while back in Avodah Zarah, but the mouse that fell into the beer. It's kind of it's a memorable sugya, but I also taught it again recently at YU. So the mouse that fell into the beer, Rav said, you're not allowed to eat, drink the beer. So the question was why. The Gemara wasn't sure. Is it because Rav believes that no sein tam lefgam is prohibited, and therefore even though the mouse, you can taste it in the beer, even though it makes the beer taste worse. Rav still holds it doesn't make a difference since you can taste the mouse. Or does Rav think that mouse improves the taste of beer? I'm surprised. I can't believe anybody could have really forgotten this cigar. But okay. What's that? Yeah, okay. So anyway, the Gemara wasn't sure what Rav's opinion was there, but this Gemara seems to be assuming Rav believes that no sein tam lefgam is prohibited. So Rav says, number one, chametz shel'avar ha-Pesach is a Torah prohibition. And therefore, it's relevant even if you didn't violate anything, even if you couldn't violate by Rabbi Matzah. There's chametz in the kelim, but you'll say to me, but it's no sein tam lefgam. So Rav says it doesn't matter. No sein tam lefgam still is aser. So if you could taste the chametz in the food that you cook at the Pesach, it will still be prohibited, even though the chametz doesn't enhance the flavor. And then there's one more point, which Rav believes, and this Shmuel agrees to, even though he disagrees with everything else. They both believe that min bimino, that if you cook whatever the chametz that was absorbed in the first pot, let's say it was a chulent, okay, let's say you assume your barley became chametz because it cooked like that, and now you make a chulent in the pot after Pesach, so Rav says that min bimino, even if it's a tiniest amount, even if you can't taste it, even if it's less than a 60th, Rav says min bimino is aser b'mashahu. So the Gemara just asked the following question. Why doesn't Rav say people can keep their kelim till after Pesach? And then cook in it. You made cholent in this pot before Pesach? Okay, so don't make cholent in it. Make something else which is not the same flavor as cholent, not the same flavor as barley. And because Rav does believe, min b'she'eno mino is b'shishim. So if you, as long as you cook that barley, that chametz barley that's absorbed in the pot is now emitted into something that's not barley, so you're fine. So the Gemara says, this is a pretty obvious answer. The Gemara says, the reason why Rav doesn't allow that is because gzeira dilma asu lemever hu bemina. That seems to be a fairly reasonable gzeira. A chulent pot is likely to be used for chulent after Pesach. So they were afraid, Rav was afraid that if you allow you to use this chametz tikka pot for some other chametz, some other food, you'll end up coming in to use it for the same food, and that would be prohibited. That was Rav's position. Shmuel amar, lo yishaveru. No need to break the pots. Avomashi lula achar zmano. You wait till after Pesach. Avibuhu bein bemino bein shelo bemino. That's Shmuel's position. What is Shmuel's position? Well, he happens to agree with Rav that chametz is that all min bemino is oser b'mashahu. That Rav and Shmuel agree. And by the way, we don't paskin like them. The only place we paskin like Rav and Shmuel is by chametz on Pesach. And not only do we paskin like Rav and Shmuel, we're more machmir, which is, or at least in principle, that they might hold that. But we chametz on Pesach, we say chametz on Pesach is prohibited no matter how much, whether it's in the same food, b'mino, b'shalomino. It doesn't make a difference. Right, so we go beyond, and Rav and Shmuel, well, Rav at least was machmir, I think, on Pesach for sure. I think Shmuel might have been also, but we are more stringent than even their general principle. Only on Pesach, year round, by everything else except for Tevel and Yayin Nesach, except for those two prohibitions, we say it doesn't matter whether it falls into Mino, it doesn't matter whether it falls into Eino Mino. You always apply the rule of Shishim. 60 is Bitul Hatam, nullifying the taste is always enough. So Shmuel probably disagrees with Rav probably on 2 points here. One, I'm not sure we have explicit evidence. He probably believes that no Saint Tam Lefgam is permitted. That if the flavor is damaging, then it's not a problem. Number two, he certainly disagrees with Rav about Chametz Sha'avar Alav HaPesach. Whereas Rav paskins like Rabbi Yehuda that Chametz that was existed during Pesach as a Torah prohibition afterwards, Shmuel says there is no Torah prohibition and it's only prohibited if a Jew happened to own it as a Knas Chachamim. There is no Knas on the Chametz inside the Kalim. Okay, so that's Shmuel's position. And now the Gemara observes, it's a very strange, it's an interesting formulation. The Ozda Shmuel Atame, and Shmuel was consistent with his position, his public position. The Omer Shmuel, I don't think too many rabbis today want me to read this passage, you'll see why in a second. The Omer Shmuel, Lahanu de Mizabne Kanade, there were people who were selling earthenware pots after Pesach. And you'll see in the conclusion of this Gemara, he was actually in, I think, Surah, which was Rav's town. So Shmuel said to the merchants the following. He said, Ashvu zvine akendichi, you better not jack up the prices on your pots after Pesach. You better sell them for their regular value. Ve'ilo darshina lechu k'Rabbi Shimon. Otherwise, I'm going to get up and paskin like Rabbi Shimon, and none of the balabatim will need to buy any new pots. And the price is going to plummet even further. In other words, he was trying to prevent price gouging. So Shmuel said, if you don't behave properly, I'm going to get up and paskin publicly for the balabatim that they don't need to buy any new pots after Pesach.
But halacha would be based on the economic factors.
Whoa. You know, so I know that people, we have said, how come rabbis can't do more to lower the price? I don't know. Kosher food, yeshiva tuition, whatever it is. So Shmuel, there's one other passage, a very powerful passage, which is much stronger than this. But here, the Gemara just says the following. The Gemara says, V'lidrosh lehu. Why does Shmuel, what is he in cahoots with the merchants? Only if they agree to sell for a fair price, then he won't really paskin. But otherwise, why didn't he paskin? That's how Shmuel holds. Shmuel holds you don't have to break the pot. So the Gemara says, Hashmuel, Rabbi Shimon Svirale. Shmuel paskins like Rabbi Shimon, that Chametz Sha'avar Alav HaPesach is only a rabbinic prohibition and only applies to Chametz a Jew owned. So the Gemara says, no, Asrei derab hava. Shmuel, in the Hardah, that's how Shmuel Paskin. The merchants didn't make good business after Pesach and Hardah. But in Surah, so Rav Paskin, that you can't use the pots after Pesach. So Shmuel got up to, and said to the merchants, you jack up the prices. Even normally, I would not deign to, since Surah was Rav's, I don't, Rav might not have been alive anymore. Even though normally in Surah, I would say, however Rav ruled, that's how what you should follow. If you don't behave properly, you try to, you know, price gouge, then I am going to paskin and tell the people they should follow Rabbi Shimon to my psach, and then you're really out of luck. So here, Shmuel basically wasn't threatening to do something that was shalok halacha. The reason why he wasn't in the first place paskining that way was out of respect for Rav and generally respect for Minhag HaMakom, but that he was willing to throw out the window if it came to the merchants extorting the people. There is a Gemara in a Mishnah in Krisus where Rabban Gamliel, the halacha is that if a woman has had multiple, let's say, miscarriages or births, so she has to bring a pair of birds for every time, or that you could have other chiyuvim as well for a zava, forget without going into the details. She could have multiple obligations of bringing pairs of birds. But it happens to be that once, let's say she wanted to eat from karbanos. So once you have brought one pair of birds, even though the woman has to bring, or her husband has to bring, the rest of the pairs of birds, she's already permitted to eat kachim. We're actually going to learn on the bottom of the first amud of brachos. The rule is that when you're tameh, any kind of tuma, so when you go, once you go to the mikveh, and you're waiting for sundown to come, so you can already eat Meiser Sheni. But you can't, if you're a Kohen or family member of a Kohen, you can't eat Truma, and nobody can eat from a Karban, and can eat any Kachim. Once the sun sets, so then Kohanim and their families can eat Truma, but if you are what's called a Mechusar Kapara, if you still have to bring a Karban, a Yoledes has to bring the birds, a Zava has to bring birds, a Zav, a man who has whatever Ziva is, has to bring birds, all of the, and a Mitzora has to bring Karbanos. So if you haven't brought your Karbanos, you can't eat Kachim yet. Normally you bring the Karbanos the next day. So let's say a woman has to bring multiple pairs of birds for multiple, let's say, births or something like that. It could even be, unfortunately, miscarriages. So under those circumstances, she or her husband has to bring all the sets of birds. But once she has brought, once the Kohen has brought one pair of the birds, she can now eat kachim. And the rest are just an obligation. Like if I'm obligated to bring a korban because I took a vow, so it's the same kind of an, doesn't stem from the same obligation, but just she had to bring five pairs of birds. She has to bring four more pairs of birds, but she can already eat kachim. So the way the Mishnah formulates it, that she brings one, she's ochalas b'kachim, v'hashar aleha chova. The rest of them are an obligation upon her, but it doesn't stop her from eating kachim already. But then the bird merchants were driving up the prices. So Rabban Gamliel got up and he said, I swear I'm not going to go to sleep tonight until the price of birds in Yerushalayim is some, like, you know, much, much lower price. And he got up and he announced that a woman who has multiple pairs of karbanos to bring, she has to bring one to eat kachim and the rest are not a chova upon her. And then the price plummeted. Okay. So that was actually a much greater statement, because there he was teaching something that was from the Shaloka halacha, because he felt that the particular time needed it. I imagine eventually they restored the halacha, but the bird merchants hopefully learned their lessons. Okay.
Economics trumped halacha.
Sometimes, yes.
It's good they didn't have gasoline.
What's that? Okay. So that's the end of the first part. Now the Gemara starts to get into regular Hechsher Kelim, with a particularly interesting halacha that we have mentioned a long time ago, which is that one is not permitted to have fleishik bread or milchik bread. What fleishik bread and milchik bread, and Tosis points out the distinction here, does not mean that I baked it in the same oven as milk or meat. It means that actually one of the ingredients in the bread is either a milchik's ingredient or a fleishik's ingredient. The only lean, of course, that would, as I actually, I'm doing the sugya now with my shir in YU of Recha Milsa, of the question of baking them at the same time. So I pointed out to them, I mentioned this, that we encountered this din, because it's quoted in, where the primary discussion takes place in the Beis Yosef in Yeridea, is along with the question of milchik and fleishik bread. So I raised the question, how can you ever have cake? You know, that's a milcha cake, because after all, cake is bread, halachically. It's pasav abekistin. If you made a meal out of your cake, you would have to wash and bench on it. And so, I mean, the answer is an obvious answer, but I asked them, why are you allowed to do any of that? In fact, why are you allowed to have pizza? Right, pizza's bread, and it's milchik. And why are you allowed to have, you know, a meat barek or anything like that? Because it's a fleishik bread. So the Gemara in Chulin says, says that it's permissible when it is Ka'in Tura, Taf Vav Resh Aleph, which literally means a shore. So what the question is, what does Ka'in Tura mean? So there are two interpretations. One is that if it is Ka'in, which is like an ox, meaning if it's a funny shape. So if there's something about the shape of the food that gives it away, so then it's not a problem. Then it's not a problem to have milchiks or fleishiks. So therefore, when you look at pizza, pizza doesn't look like regular bread, it looks like pizza. When you have have a calzone, so you know that there's something inside, you know it's not regular bread, and therefore it doesn't fall under the gzera. The reason for the gzera, by the way, was because they used to eat bread with every meal. That was sort of their staple, and then they'd have a little meat on the side, a little hummus on the side, whatever it was, and because or cheese, and therefore the Chachamim did not want there being fleishik or milchik bread, because they were afraid that people would eat the bread with the opposite species, and therefore the halacha was that bread, that the kind of bread that's normally eaten with a meal, has to be parv. The other explanation of ka'in tura means literally like the eye, ayin shell is ayin tura. If it's a very small amount of food that's going to be consumed at that meal, then that would be permitted as well. So if you had a particular, let's say you were making a small challah for a Shabbos meal or something like that, and you wanted to make it a somehow, I don't know, I guess to smear schmaltz in it or mix, you know, kosher fat into the, you know, baking the bread, so that would be permissible if you made a very small amount that would be consumed at that meal. Okay, so anyway, that's a prohibition. Now, what it does, we discussed at some length, what happens if you bake bread in an oven at the same time as meat. So we shown in Paskin that if you cooked kosher meat and treif meat in the oven at the same time and they're not touching, so most we shown in Paskin that the kosher meat remains kosher, that recha isn't considered milsa. But we spent a lot of time exploring a very odd position of the Rif, where the Rif said, yes, that's true, that's how the Rif Paskins, but if you bake bread and kosher meat in the oven at the same time, you're not allowed to eat that bread with milchiks. The angle through which it was analyzed is the Rif said that that's called a davar sheyesh lamatir. Whenever you have something that will be eventually permitted, there's no bittul on it when it gets mixed into something else. You just wait till the time comes when the food is permitted in its own right. So the Rif, sort of twisting that concept a little bit, said since you can eat the meat, the bread, with meat right now or parv right now, therefore you're not allowed to eat it with milk at all. But that's a case. That's a case, as Tosis points out here, where it's not that there was a fleshic ingredient in the bread, or the bread came in contact directly with the meat. That's a case where the meat and the bread were not touching, it was just the reach of the meat and the bread, and that's not enough to make it prohibited. So the Gemara says the following here. Rabba hahu tanura, there was an oven, the tahu beiti chaya. So they apparently smeared, Rashi says, on the floor of the oven. Remember how their ovens were constructed? I think others would probably say on the wall. Their ovens usually you had were like a barrel shape with a little opening on top. You'd stick the bread in and stick it to the walls, and the fire would go on the bottom the bread would be directly exposed. Whatever Rashi says, it's on the. I'm not sure what Rashi envisioned here, but I think most assume what it means here is that when you smeared it with the schmaltz, with the meat, so you then the bread came directly in contact with it and it got flavor into the bread. So Rab Asra Rabba Bar Eloi Lamechla Lerifta Afilu Bemilcha Leolam. Rabba said that any bread baked in that oven, with oven which had been smeared with the schmaltz, you cannot eat it even with salt. It means you can't eat it at all. And it's not just you can't eat it with milk. You can't eat it at all. And for any bread baked in this oven, Leolam, forever, there's nothing you can do. Dilma Asi Lamechla Bekutcha. Maybe you will come to end up eating the bread with a kutcha, is a yogurt, or some type of a sour milk dip, and therefore you're not allowed to eat the bread at all. So now the Gemara says so that you can't eat the bread at all that was baked in the now. That's the Gemara is not going to have a problem with. The problem the Gemara is going to have with is a statement of the olam. You're never able to eat stuff baked in that oven. Now, the truth is, if you asked me, the Gemara is not going to give this answer, so obviously I'm wrong. But I would have said, Asra lemechla la'olam. You're not allowed to eat that bread forever. It doesn't mean you can never bake again in that oven. Okay, but the Gemara doesn't assume that way. It assumes that even though you keep reheating the oven each time, the next time you heat the oven to bake bread, Rabba Bar Eli said it would be prohibited to eat that bread. So now the Gemara says, Meisvei, we have a question from Abraisa. Ein lashin esa isa b'chalab. You're not allowed to knead dough with milk. V'imlosh kol hapas kula asura, and there if you did, and I don't know if I really can remember ever having it, but supposedly bread made with butter is supposed to be very, very good, and cakes made with butter are much better than made with margarine. You're disagreeing, Marshall? Okay, they named the bakery in Tinek from long ago Butterflake for a reason, not margarine flake. Okay.
That's terrible. That's true.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Ouch. Okay. So in lashon esa isa b'chalav in lash kol hapas kula asura mipnei hergel avera, because you will come to eat it with fleshiks. Kayotze bo, turn the page. Ein toshen es hatan rabalya, exactly what happened. You're not allowed to smear the oven with schmaltz. The alya is literally tail fat. V'im tosh, if you did, kol hapas kula asura. Ad sheyasik es hatanur, until you fire the oven again. In other words, what they would do is they would before they put the bread in, they would, it's like not like different than a brick oven. First you heat the oven up, and then once they had really heated the oven up, so then they would put the bread in. So what you have to do is you have to refire the oven, and that's enough, and effectively to kosher the oven, enough for these purposes at least, and therefore you would be able to eat if you baked another time, but not the first time. So the Gemara says, Hahusa katana, but if you did, the Braisa says, you can't use this kind of pas achi yasik es atana until you fire the oven again. But Hahusa katana, if it was fired again, miha shari, it would be permitted. So the Gemara says, Tiyufta the Rabba Bar Ilai, Tiyufta. In fact, it is a refutation of Rabba Bar Ilai's view, and therefore, yes, if you smear the oven up with the schmaltz and then you bake the bread in it, you're not allowed to eat that bread, but if you fire it up another time, then that's a sufficient kasher. From here, the Gemara is now going to transition into coming back to our topic and how you kasher stuff on Pesach.
Rabbi, can I ask one
yes.
question? So today, can we, in our regular ovens, can we like bake a challah and then use that oven for either dairy or meat, or no?
I mean, there are different opinions.
And I don't have two ovens.
We don't have two ovens either. We do, but we have a convection regular oven. We use the oven for milchus and fleishiks, not at the same time. That is Rosh Hechter's psak. That is the Shulchan Aruch's psak.
24 hours?
No.
Okay.
No. Rosh Hechter says, wait till the oven cools down. If you open up the oven and leave it for 10 minutes to air out, that's fine as well. And if you didn't, the food is certainly kosher. It's not a problem. Yes. I assume that is pretty common minhag in our community. I know that chadashim mikarov ba'u, we have newcomers and so on, or some people will make sure they cover one or the other. It was Ramosha's position, cover one or the other when they cook it when they bake in the oven. That was Ramosha's position. It is very difficult that it's pretty clear the Shulchan Aruch doesn't paskin that way. The Rishonim didn't paskin that way. And the only Ramosha's idea came from this notion that besides recha, which we paskin is not a problem, whatever reach is, zeya, which means literally sweat, it means the moisture is a problem. I think suffice it to say, there's one position that's a position of the Rashba that's quoted by the Shulchan Aruch that no one disagrees with. The Rashba said that the prohibition l'chatchila of cooking milk and meat together, or kosher and kosher together, only applies when you're roasting it. If it's in a kedera, in a pot, two pots, you can do it at the same time. Now,
uncovered,
at the same time, l'chatchila. Now, understand something. We all understand that. If you want to know where there's going to be much, 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 much more steam coming off of something, it's going to be in a pot because in a pot there's liquid. But now, and even though I think with Ramah is machmir normally not to do them at the same time, it's explicit. Bizeh harzeh, one pot at the pot for sure is permitted. In fact. So I think it's absolutely clear. It's a very difficult position that Ramosha has espoused. There's one line somewhere in Shulchan Aruch that talks about Zaya, but I presume it has to be a very different kind of case. Perhaps if you took a pot and you put it basically in the oven on the rack where it was basically flush with the top of the oven, that could be a problem. That's like the cover of a pot. But short of that, in our ovens, milchiks now, fleishiks later, is permitted l'chatchila. You know, Rosh Hechter says to let it cool down in between because there's still reach in the oven. So that wouldn't prohibit the food, but l'chatchila, you're not supposed to cook in there. So you wait a little bit to cool down. But after that, it's not a problem.
And whether it's with liquid, cooking with liquid?
Doesn't make a difference. Makes no difference. Again, you would think liquid is worse. Ramosha, I think, is Mako. Ramosha would say if you're always cooking solids in there, more like baking, then Ramosha says it's not a problem. But once you have stuff that's liquidy at all, so then it's a problem with Zeya, right? Then it's got to be one or the other. And that's a very, very difficult position to square with the Rashba. When I asked Rosh Hechter about this many years ago, so I don't quite see this in the Tshuvas, but the way this was his description, which was, yeah, it's against the Shulchan Aruch. And so he said someone wrote to Ramosha. There are two Tshuvas. Someone wrote to Ramosha asking a bunch of questions saying, but it's against the Shulchan Aruch. So he said Ramosha writes another whole Tshuva explaining everything, but at the end of the day, he doesn't explain how it's not against the Shulchan Aruch. It's not against the Shulchan Aruch. And when I say not against the Shulchan Aruch, I don't mean just the Shulchan Aruch. I think if you look at all that we've shown him, you know, up to the Shulchan Aruch, and the Nosei Kehem, the Shulchan Aruch, nobody disagrees on this, that if you're cooking them on the whole discussion, because not everybody paskins Lakula on the question of Recha Lav Milsahi. It was a we do this Rav and Levi. I don't remember if we did it here. Rav and Levi have a machlokas in Gemara Psachim whether or not if you roast the two things together at the same time, treif, you know, a nevela and kosher meat at the same time, whether it makes it prohibited or not. So most Rishonim paskin like Levi, but Rabbi Nutam and some of Chachmei Ashkenaz do paskin like Rav that is prohibited, but they are lenient in a big oven that has some kind of an opening, which probably our ovens qualify for. I'm pretty sure most of our ovens, it's 12 esronim. I don't know how big exactly that is, but a couple of yore cycles ago, I think one of the guys figured it out. Most of our ovens are that large, and our ovens are vented. Pretty much everybody would agree that if you did it at the same time, it wouldn't make the food prohibited. But we all agree also, you don't do it at the same time. But that's the entire discussion Shulchan Aruch is about at the same time. Bezeh achar zeh, the Ramah just has a throwaway line at the end. Of course that's permitted.
Practically, the
shoe
was probably 50 years old.
Yeah. They must have covered stuff. Those who were following Russia must have covered, right. I understand 50 years ago that we were a much less wealthy community. Most people did not have two ovens. Correct. So they would say you have to cover one. Okay. That's what they would say. Yeah. So I think that according to this position, an oven that's clean, even though it's been used for treif and even used in 24 hours, you can also cook in it because reicha lav milsahi. Period. So you know, as I always tell people, you move it to the oven, you want to kosher. Move it to the apartment, you want to kosher the apartment. Okay, so turn the oven up for an hour on its highest setting, done. You know, but fundamentally speaking, al pi din, it doesn't matter if it's actually an oven is not, you know, a regular oven is not an issue. So as long as it's clean, if there was tray food that spilled in the oven and it's not totally burnt up, so now it's a recha milsa problem. Like it's like cooking nevela and shchut on the oven at the same time, which won't make the food prohibited, but you're not allowed to do. Okay, so anyway, so now the Gemara says the following. If that's true, Amar le Ravina Ravashi, v'chime achar de'itosav Rabba Bar Ilai, since Rabba Bar Ilai's position was, to use an, I guess refuted, for those who are of a little older than I am, who learned in traditional yeshivas, the word I would use, Benny, you probably never heard this word, I suspect, it was upschlund. Okay. That's the best word to capture itosav. It was refuted or rejected. Did you ever hear that word? Okay, there you go. You know. I went to a relatively Haredi elementary school yeshiva through sixth grade. So I got the language. So, and a little bit in MTA is where I come. So anyway, so since his position was rejected, so amai ka'amarav kederes pa'pesach yishaveru. Why did you say the pots have to be broken? Why don't you just heat them again? Why don't you fire them up again? So first the Gemara says, Amar le hasam tanur shel mateches, hocha b'kedera shel cheres. No. Rob was talking about earthenware stuff. Earthenware stuff, maybe you can't kasher. We're going to talk about that in a moment. You can't do hagala on it. You can't boil it. But we'll talk about what you could do in theory. And Rabbi Bar Ilai was talking about a metal oven. A metal oven, you fire it up again, you're done. So that's one approach the Gemara suggests to resolve the possible contradiction. If you want, you can give a different approach. Now, we're talking about a pottery oven, an earthenware oven. The issue is the following. When you cook in a pot, so the food gets absorbed on one side. The fire that you want to use to get it out is being used on the other side the next time you cook with the pot. That's no good. The only way to get it out with cheres is to fire it from the place that the food was actually absorbed. By an oven, if you smear the inside of the oven, some part of that with the schmaltz, so now when you fire it the next time, it's hesek omi bifnim. In other words, the fire is being applied to the surface that actually absorbed the prohibited substance. And therefore, if you want a kasher, you can't, as the Gemara will comment later, you can never do hagala on cheres. You can never take pottery, earthenware, and put it in the boiling water, because HaTorah he'ida al klei cheres she'ena yotze midei dofil olam. The Torah has testified by telling us to break the pots in the Beis HaMikdash, the earthenware pots that they cook korbanos in, by telling us to break them, the Torah is telling us that you can never get everything out of the earthenware pot. But when it comes to libun, which is not extracting the absorptions, but it's burning them where they are, so as long as you apply the fire to the same surface the same way, that would be sufficient. But pots, you don't do from the inside. So then the Gemara continues. Why don't you just put the coals on the inside? So the Gemara says, Rav didn't allow that because chayis alei mishum depaka. He's not going to allow that because people are not going to do a good job because they're afraid it's going to break the pottery. In other words, if you apply the fire in that way, it's going to overdo it, and therefore they'll do a very quick, half-baked job, and therefore Rav was afraid you wouldn't do a sufficient job. But in principle, in theory, it should work. It's why their poskim allow, if you want to, I mentioned this before, if you inherit very fancy, or you come across very fancy china, and you want to kosher it, you can kosher it by putting it in a self-cleaning oven. Recommendation is test one or two pieces first to see that it doesn't destroy it. But once you do that, firstly, you're getting it from all sides, number one. And number two, once you put it in, you can't really stop it. There's no concern that chayis alev alopaka, you're going to have rachmanis on it so that it won't break. You know you've taken your chances, it will break or it won't break, and you're done. Okay. So now, the Gemara says, in light of this, Hilkach, hai buchya, and buchya Rashi says, is some type of tile oven made from clay tiles. So a tile oven which you want to kosher. So haseko mibachutsu v'asu. It is normally fired from the outside, whatever this was, and therefore you can't kosher it. But v'i malya gumre, if you fill it up with coals, and I guess maybe people weren't afraid that it would break, firing it is not enough, in the normal fashion that you normally fire it up. But if you want to fill it up with hot coals, shapir dami, then you're allowed to do so. Again, the assumption here, I think, is that you weren't afraid that it would break, but you have to just do the koshering properly. You have to fire it, in effect, from the inside. Amar le Ravina la Ravashi. Hai sakine de pisha hechi avdina lehu. You want knives for Pesach, how do you deal with them? Now, there is, by the way, I should note, a myth, and I will say it, it's clearly a myth about knives on Pesach. People say that you cannot kosher two-part knives. As far as I know, there's no basis for this whatsoever. It's based upon a misunderstanding, a misreading of the Shulchan Aruch. You only need to see this Gemara to realize that it's wrong.
Two-part knives being fine is what?
No, you have like a handle. You have a handle. You have a wooden handle, let's say, and you have a knife blade, and with the rivets that hold it in. So now people can't do that. There is a Raman Shulchan Aruch says that you can't kasher the nadan of a sakin. I think there are people who misunderstood this. What a nadan is a sheath. It means if you stick a knife into something, unless you can, if you could unsew it, I don't know what they were made of. Unless you open it up, there's no way to clean inside. It's not about absorptions. You can't, if like little crumbs of chametz got in, there's no way to get in there. So the nadan shasakin is what the Rama says. A nadan is not a handle. Now, the only time a handle is a problem, and it's a problem generally in kashering, is if the handle is loose. And the concern is that you can't get inside it. But if the handle, as it's been used, has always been on solidly, and the handle is still on solidly, you can kosher a two-part knife like you can kosher anything else. And that will be explicit in a moment in our Gemara. So Ravina asked Ravashi, how do you kosher a two-part knife? How do you kosher a knife at Pesach? So Amar Le Liditi Chadet HaKavdinan. Now Ravashi was the Rosh Shiva, said, we make new knives. So that's very nice, but Amar Le Tenach Mar De Efshar Le, that's very nice. You're well off. You can afford to do that. The Lo Efshar Le Mai. What about most people who can't afford just to buy all new kalim for Pesach? So he said, no, Anak Ein Chadet HaKamina. I didn't mean I buy new knives. I make it like it's new. How do I do that? Katayu Betina. I take the handle and I coat it in mud. It's made out of wood. Uparzalayu benura. Then I put the blade, the metal blade, in fire. Vahadar, afterwards, he takes the clay off, or the mud off. And ma'ilina likatayu berotchen. Then I put the handle part, which I didn't kasher yet, I put it in boiling water. So you see, number one, that when you kasher the knife, you have to kasher the entire knife. Number two, you see that you can kasher two-part knife. Number three, you see that you can kosher a kli in stages, which is true. If you have a kli, let's say you have a really long knife. We have this. We have a very long meat knife. And I don't think it will fit into any one of our pots. So the way I kosher the meat knife for Pesach is I boil the water, I stick the knife in, it gets probably 2/3 of the knife. I stick the, hold it by the handle, stick it in. Then, when I leave it in for a moment, I then, and the water's still boiling, I pick it up with the tongs, or maybe by the handle, and now I drop it in the other way with the handle in, and now the entire thing has been submerged. You can do Haggalah in two parts.
You have to kashu the tongs first.
If they're clean and haven't been used for 24 hours, you don't. Same thing with the pot.
Is that true for
tefillah
too?
No. Tefillah has to be done b'vasachas. Right? The shear of a mikvah, a 40 saw, is based upon mayim shekol gufo shel adam olo behem, enough that a person could immerse themselves at once. Tefillah does not work for chatzayim. Tefillah on a person, tefillah on kelim. That's about, I'll call it, a relationship between the person and the water. This is really just about getting something out of the knives, and it can be done in two parts.
Okay. Regardless of what the material the handle is made of.
Yeah, unless it's made of pottery.
Pottery
would be a problem, but if it's made of
wood?
It's made of wood, it's fine. That's what this was made of. I don't think it's a problem made of plastic either. There's a reason. The level of koshering probably required for the handle in most cases may not be the same level as for the blade, because normally it's only with splatters and things like that. But the Gemara says you kosher the handle as well. Hold on. You don't need me. Just read, you know, there's no prohibition of your reading ahead of line. I'm boring you, so just read ahead of line. So the Gemara says, V'hilchasa idi berotchen ubekli rishon. The Gemara says, literally the next line, the halacha is, despite what Rav Ashi said, is both parts only need to go in boiling water in a kli rishon. Now the assumption is, kibolo kach poto. The way it absorbs is the way it emits. The question is, so clearly, Tosa says Rav Ashi was maybe machmir upon himself. This is really the question. The Gemara here says that a sakin only requires Haggalah. But Tosa says, I'm not going to deal with the whole issue now until at least we finish the Gemara. Tosas, the top Tosa says, V'hilchasa idi v'idi berochen, tema, t'tanya b'tosefta t'avodazara, hasakin v'ashpud v'askala. So we concentrated when we learned the Gemara last week on the spit and the grate, but the tosefta also has a knife. All these three things, malabnan ba'or. And also, in the first parak of Chulin, Amar Kigon Shalimne Ba'or. The Gemara wants to talk about how a knife was kasher, and it said you were malabing it in or. Alma Tzarech Libun. So the question is, why does the Gemara here say a knife only requires Haggalah, and elsewhere it says that a knife requires Libun? And the two answers, one answer we explore, one answer is I think I've said this many times. The Balabatish answer is not in the base walls of the base medrash. People who know will say that when you say something is a Balabatish answer, it's a put down. It's a snub. I don't think that way. Actually, I think very often Balabatish answers are better than conceptual answers. But in this particular case, there's a Balabatish answer and there's a conceptual answer. The Balabatish answer is you talk about two different kinds of knives. Presumably, one which is used directly on the fire, and therefore the blade requires libun because it absorbs with a non-liquid medium. And the other is a kind of knife that wouldn't be used on the fire. The other possible answer is the one Tosas offers here, and will be discussed on the long Tosas that we'll do the day of the Siyam at the end of Avodah Zarah, is that there's a difference between Chametz and Isser. Tosas here says Chametz before Pesach is considered Hetera Bala. And therefore, as I mentioned last week, the rule is if it's milk alone or meat alone, or if you believe that chametz before Pesach is called heter at that time, obviously you're allowed to eat it. But if it has the status not yet of chametz, then no matter what you do, you only need Haggalah, even if it's used directly on the fire. Whenever something is, and the other example was kachim, that gets absorbed when you cook it in the pot, that pot never requires libun, even if it was grilled on the pot, on the spit, or whatever else, because when it absorbed, it was heter. Whenever it's heter abala, the maximum you require, as long as it's clean, you can access everything, is Haggalah. Only when something absorbs iser, something that's prohibited at the time, the Gemara says on the last daf in Avodah Zarah, only then do we distinguish between libun and Haggalah. Whereas if it absorbs without a liquid medium, then you require libun, and with a liquid medium, you only require Haggalah. But if it's hetera bala, then you should never require libun, no matter how it was used, even directly on the fire. And that's one of the two answers Tosus gives here, that chametz before Pesach is hetera bala, and that's why the knife, no matter what, only requires Haggalah. So we don't paskin that way. As I mentioned last week, we paskin that chametz before Pesach is isura bala, and therefore we do require libun on things you want to use for Pesach that we use directly, you know, without a liquid medium. But there's a whole group of Rishonim who disagree, who would say that you basically never need to do Libun for Pesach, because Chametz before Pesach is Heter Habalah. The only time you would need to do probably Libun for those Rishonim is if you didn't do it before Pesach, and since you can't do Haggalah on Pesach, because as we explained why last week, Haggalah relies upon the mechanism of Bittul, and Bittul doesn't work on Chametz at all on Pesach, no matter how much you have. So we never, Ashkenazim can never do Haggalah, no matter what, on Pesach with the water. But you can kasher through Libun on Pesach. So that's the only time those Rishonim who say that Chametz before Pesach is really Heter, Heter Habalah, that's the only time they would say you need Libun for Pesach. But we don't paskin that way. We paskin that that it's like all other prohibited foods. Marshall?
If you sold your Chametz, would that include the Chametz that was in the pot on which you wanted to do Libun, which would actually make it impermissible because you're destroying someone else's Chametz?
Nah.
Why?
Because think about what the terms of the sale were. Do you think the guy cares? Was the guy ever going to go? He was going to go to your clean and just inhale and pull the chametz out. That's a useless. It's hefker. That blows blios.
That's respectfully only partially permissible. I don't expect the guy to come eat my box of Cheerios either.
No, but could the guy even come? If you ask the guy, if you sold your liquor to the guy, like once upon a time, and the guy really might want your liquor, he wouldn't appreciate being told he can't have your very fine, aged scotch, because he bought it from you. But clearly nobody's interested in the Blios of Kalem. So I don't think anybody's machbid on that. Right? Even if it were a genuine sale, the guy wouldn't be machbid on it. So, okay. So anyway, the Gemara continues, Boi mine. Who asked? Mimareimar. Hani mane. Oh, I don't know if I read the last line. Klibi shown kosavar kibolo kach polto. The way it absorbs is the way it emits, and since the... Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped. Now I see what I skipped. Amrav humrebrei dervishua, eats parur. If you have a wooden spoon that you stir the pot with. Magila barotchin uba klibi shown. Use boiling water and in a klibi shown, meaning not in a klisheni or something not as hot. Kosavar kibolo kach polto. What people often have been asking this question, well, how can you kasher wood? It absorbs. The answer is yes, it absorbs. It absorbs and it emits. That's the principle, kibolo kach polto. Cheres is the exception. Earthenware is the exception where we assume that even though it can absorb, it can't fully emit. But wood, the same way the wood spoon absorbed when you stirred the soup or whatever you stirred with it, the same way you kasher the wood spoon. That's all. Okay. Bo mine mimreimar. Hane mani dekunya mahu l'ishtamushe be bepischa. Mani de kunya, so today we would not permit using these kalim at all. Not for halachic reasons, but for medical reasons. These were earthenware kalim, don't gasp, coated with lead. They say, I don't know if it's true, right, the decline of the Roman Empire was partially contributed to by the lead in the aqueducts. Don't know if it's true or not. So it sounds like a good story, but we would not recommend, I think, drinking any of these kalim. But they were earthenware coated with lead. So apparently there were different kinds. It had to do with the different earth sources for the clay, for the pottery. So the Gemara says the following. Yeroka, if they are green or maybe yellow, loti bailach, the vade asiri. Rashi says that the earth that was taken for this was replaced with a mitzaref alum. If that's aluminum, it's probably bauxite of some kind, which sometimes is yellow or brown. So maybe that's why the color of Yeroka. I'm not sure. So if it's Yeroka, loti bailach. The Gemara says, for sure, devadai asiri. It's certainly asur, because clearly the Gemara assumes it's bolea, that we know. However, kiti bailach, uchme v'chivare, black and white, earthen, pottery. Mai, v'hecha de'isbehu kartufani, if there are cracks in it, for sure loti bailach, that it absorbs. Devadai asiri, I don't know if it's cracks in the lead, Kiti bailach deshiye, if they're very smooth, because the more smooth something is, the fewer cracks, the less porous it's going to be. So the Gemara says, Amar lei, Ramreimar responded to his questioner, Chazina lehu de medaisi, alma bali vaasiri, de hatora heidal klecheresh en yotze medidaf yololam. So he says the following, we see, or I see, that the something, I don't know what this means. I know what the words mean. Rashi explains it better in Avodah Zarah. We learned this Gemara in Avodah Zarah. You may have forgotten it. So did I. If you remember that, then I'm really impressed. But it was like way back. Of Laflamid Gimel. It's like 3-4 years ago at least. So Medaisei means the Kli sweats somehow. It looks, I mean, I assume there's condensation on the outside. Is what the Rishonim say, and somehow that indicates that the Kli is absorbing. I'm not sure why that is, but that's what they say. So therefore, since it's Medaisei, we know that it must absorb, and it's Usur because the Torah says that once a Kli Cheres has absorbed, it's Eino Yotzimi De Dofil Olma. It can never get rid of its bad stuff completely. So now the Gemara asks, and this is why it's an Avodah Zarah. How is this different? The law here by stuff for Pesach, by these money de kunya, these earthenware lead-coated kelim, why is it different by Pesach versus by Yayin Nesach, when the non-Jews' wine was stored in it? The Darish Meremar, money de kunya, these very same vessels, bein uchma, bein chivari, bein yiroke, any of the colors, even green, shari, you're allowed to use them, it's not a problem. V'chitema, and if you want to suggest that the reason why there we are lenient is Yayin Nesach, the prohibition is only the Rabbanon. In other words, most wine of a non-Jew is only a rabbinic prohibition because most wine of a non-Jew was not actually libated to Avodah Zarah. It's just a rabbinic gezerah. So if you want to say that Yayin Nesach is only the Rabbanon, but Chametz is a Doraisa prohibition, v'ha called the Tikkun Rabbanon, k'ein Doraisa Tikkun. No, whenever the Chachamim make Takanos, they generally model them upon Torah prohibitions, and therefore they should have prohibited it similarly. So Amar Lei, Maremar answered, no, you got it all wrong. Zet hashmisho ayidei chamin, v'zet hashmisho ayidei tzonin. You know why they're different? Because the goy's kelim can't absorb very much, the goy's wine, because it's all cold. Here, we're talking about chametz that was potentially used hot stuff, hot liquids, whatever else it was, and that's why it absorbs much more, and therefore you can't kasher it to Pesach, whereas we are not worried when it comes to Yayin Nesach. Okay. Fine. And now the Gemara gives us the rule about things for Pesach. We don't observe most of these rules today. We are infinitely more machmir. But the Gemara says the following. My wife likes to joke about me that I wanted the kasher of the bread machine to make matzah in. It's not really true. But, you know, I was shocked. A colleague of mine was discussing how for the Balabatim he had a kasher, a toaster oven for Pesach. And I was a little horrified. But he said something which was actually important. He said, you know, for some of us, maybe the $30 or $40, $50 to replace it is not a big deal. But for some people, it really is a big deal. So he gave people instructions how you could crash your toaster oven. In my home, that would never fly. Okay, but that's the way it is.
It's all metal.
It's hard to clean it too, though. You know, but again, I'm not arguing. You know, there are many things that are halachically permitted that would horrify any traditional balabaster. Okay, I told you the story already. I don't have to repeat the story. Rav and Chaim, when his mother was sick and Rebbetzin came down and so on, right? You and your Yoredeya are trafing at my kitchen. The punchline is sufficient. Okay. Amar Rava bar Abba, Amar Rechia bar Ashi, Amar Shmuel. Kol ha-kelim she-nishtamshu b'hem chametz b'tzonein, mishtamish b'hem matzah chutzman b'se'ar, holoshchem u'tzakasha. Any kli that was used year-round, only with cold chametz, just wipe, it's clean, and you can use it, you know, on Pesach with everything kosher Pesach. Okay, Adrian, I'm sorry to see you out here. Would that ever happen in your? Exactly. That's exactly the point. Okay, I knew that would never happen, but that's the halacha. Except for a base or a place where the sourdough sat, because the assumption is that sourdough is like kind of charif, and it will leave more flavor in there, and therefore, at least just to wipe it out is insufficient. Hoel shechimutso kasha. It's leavening. It's very tough. Amar Ravashi uves charoses, a vessel in which charoses was made, and it involves vinegar, something very strong, and flour. So it has the same din as a base or shechimotso is kasha, and you can't use it just as it is for Pesach. The simple interpretation is you can kasher it with Hagala. That would be sufficient. I think that's how the Shulchan Aruch paskins. And finally, Amar Rava, Hani Agone de Mechoza, Rashi is in Areva, it's like a kneading trough. These Arevos, Agone of the people of Mechoza, that's where Rava lived, Hoel Utadiri Lemelish Bahu, Chamira, they regularly knead in it sourdough. We say kol chamira v'chami'ah in the uh, in the uh, in the Kol Hamira, right? In that formulation, we say our Pesach for Bitul Chametz, Chami'a with an ayin is Chametz. It's cognate with the Hebrew ayin and Sadi. But Chamira is Sa'or. It's sourdough. So it was intensely. Chametz could just be leaven, but sourdough is very, very concentrated. So they make sourdough in it. Umashu bo Chamira. They leave it there. Therefore, it's Kibes Sa'or Shechimutzo Kasha. Even though the kli isn't used only for those purposes, because it's used for that, it's treated like a base sa'or. Pshita. So yeah, what's the chiddush? So the Gemara says, no, ma'u detema kevan derevicha. It's really an open surface. In other words, the base sa'or was like a closed kli. But this is kind of an open flat, mostly open and flat. Maybe it's got a little room around the side. So you would have thought, kevan derevicha, Shalit b'hu aviva, because it's open air, you know, the kind of clears it out, helps clean air it out a bit more. You would have thought for lobali it doesn't absorb the same thing. So kamashmalan. Okay, so these halachas are all quoted in Or Chaim in Hilchos Pesach. Most of the, even though hechsher kelim really belongs in Yeridea, and there are two simanim there. The simanim in Or Chaim are actually much longer. Much longer and have many more of the details. Most of the details were left out in Yeridea because they're already addressed when it comes to Pesach and in Or Chaim and Hilchos Pesach. Okay, so we will stop here.